And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your weekly, well, bi-weekly, well, bi-monthly, well, whenever the hell we can do an episode, Journey Through the Wormhole, Listen to the Prophet. I am Andrew Leyland, and I am joined today by the two best officers in the Two True Freaks fleet, Mr. Paul Spataro and Mr. Sean Engel. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey there, Andy.
You both all right?
Yep,
it's awake.
It's very, very early.
See, it's even better for me because our clocks have gone back an hour.
Yeah, you get that extra hour of sleep. You've already gotten that extra hour of sleep. We've got to wait until tomorrow, so.
Oh, bummer, man. You're giving away when we're recording it.
Oh, well. We're
supposed to be keeping these timeless.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that went well. Do we have anything to discuss before we get into this week's episode?
Well, I'd kind of like to discuss something. This is going to be coming out near... Well, this is going to be coming out in November, I think. And so people are going to be looking for Christmas shopping. And I want to tell people about the last season of Star Trek Next Generation is coming out on Blu-ray. So that should be coming up around December. And if you want to pick that up, you can go through the link at Two True Freaks and go to Amazon and pick that up, and that'll shoot a little bit of money back to us. But the thing that people are wondering about after they finish up the Blu-rays for Next Generation is, are they going to do Blu-rays for Deep Space Nine? And there has been some controversy, because essentially with Next Generation, most of that stuff was shot on film and then transferred to video, and for the Blu-ray releases, they were able to take the film and spice it up and transfer it to a format that would work for high-definition TVs and Blu-ray players. With Deep Space Nine, since a lot of the shots are CGI or digital, they'd have to basically do like they did for the original series and rework a lot of the special effects. So there's sort of controversy whether or not they're going to be doing this. And people have been saying, if you want Blu-ray releases of Deep Space Nine, perhaps the best thing that you should do is go out and purchase Blu-ray releases of The Next Generation, the original series, Enterprise. Let people know that you're interested in this. And if CBS Paramount sees that there's a demand for more Star Trek on Blu-ray, this will probably prompt them to go make an effort to put out a good Blu-ray release of Deep Space Nine. So just wanted to mention that.
Do you think that would work?
I would throw in on that, if people are going out and doing Christmas shopping, just get in touch with me and I will give you my home address to send good stuff to.
See, I don't know that that works necessarily, because I think of all of the shows, DS9 is the one that has a divergent fan base. There are people that don't like the other shows that like Deep Space Nine, and there are people that like the other shows a lot that don't like DS9. I think it has the reputation of being the redheaded stepchild for a reason.
I think Voyager also has that, though.
Yeah, but Voyager's crap.
Yes. but there, you know,
sorry, Luke.
There's some people who swear by it, and some people yeah. can't stand it.
Yes, put me in the latter camp. So, and also you've got to think as well, when they remastered the original and they remastered Next Gen, since they did those, they have been all over television, or certainly over here they have. Star Trek, the original, has now been on about 3 or 4 different channels since they remastered it. So they have got that in perpetuity cash flow coming in now to outlay the expense. DS9 doesn't really get rerun as much as the other shows.
That is true.
Certainly over here it doesn't. I can find the original, Next Gen, Voyager all on at the moment. Deep Space Nine's on, but it's kind of buried in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I had purchased a complete run, DVD run of DS9, I don't know, it's got to be close to 10 years ago, off eBay. And, you know, I was wondering what I was getting at the time, but, you know, it's got some form of Asian writing on it, on the back of it, and I'm sure it's some sort of bogus run on them, but they play fine in my DVD player, they look good, so I'm good.
So you don't think there's that much of a demand for a spiced up like what they did for the original series, sort of updating some of the special effects?
I don't think they updated the special effects for TNG.
Well, I'm pretty certain they didn't, because what I read from this one website was that for TNG, most of the effects were just cleaned up since they were all practical effects and on the film. A lot of the effects that...
My understanding as well is that the Next Generation hasn't cost them as much as the original did, but the original offset that cost by the fact that it was all shot on 35mm film anyway. So the live action footage was just a case of cleaning it up so they could offset the special effects costs. And there was no interaction really between the special effects and the actors in the original, making it very easy for them to redo the effects. By the time you start getting into Next Gen and Deep Space Nine, there's effects happening on screen with the actors, which isn't as easy, is my understanding, to clean up or to go in and alter.
Yep, that's basically what I heard as well. So that makes it more difficult, and it kind of makes it gives Paramount and CBS an impetus not to want to do a Blu-ray version of Voyager or Deep Space Nine. So you're kind of thinking that this might not, you know, the best bet we'll probably get for these two series would probably be DVD.
Yeah, I think I don't. Well, you know what? It almost seems like Blu-rays are becoming passé already anyway, because of the digital ability to get a hold of files between Netflix or Amazon Prime or more nefarious means.
Yeah, and which it's a shame, because Blu-ray is still the best quality for watching at home. I've not seen HD quality on anything else that is as good as a Blu-ray disc. But I mean, the technology will ultimately get there.
I've watched on Netflix. They have this stuff that they say is in super high HD, and it looks nice, but it's still not quite the quality of Blu-ray. If you have your TV set up correctly with like HDMI and set up to your Blu-ray player, you get a really great picture. Watching on Netflix also depends upon what your internet connection is, what speed that you're getting through to the TV or to the Blu-ray player. So. Yes, Blu-ray is that, but I think the fact that things are more on demand with, like what you said, Paul, with Amazon or with Netflix or with Hulu or whatever other service that you're going through, it just sort of makes Blu-ray kind of passe, kind of not the option that people would want to go with.
Which is a shame.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the one advantage, you know, we were talking about, you know, getting eyeglasses and all of that. As my eyeglasses get worse, I'm finding that the lack of HD just doesn't bother me as much. Yeah.
You need a shot of Retinox.
Retinox 5, isn't it?
That's the one.
I thought Paul was allergic to Retinox.
That's why we've had to get him those ridiculous Ben Franklin bifocals.
You know, keep those, and if you ever need to sell them, you can go to the past, and then they'll be a gift once again.
Yeah, how does that work then?
I don't know.
Yeah, that always confused me when he said that.
Yeah, there'll be a gift again, and Spock's just like, what? How does that, no, you're not understanding time. We've not got the time. Let's just get on with it.
you're not going to go back to time to get them again. You're going to get them and you're going to give them away again.
Anyway, should we talk about the show?
Yes, let's.
I want you off this station.
Star Trek's Q puts the station on a collision course with disaster.
My advice to you is to evacuate now.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Do we have to?
Yes, we do. I think you're giving away what you thought of this one. Q-Less, the teleplay, it was by Robert Hewitt Wolfe, story by Hannah Louise Shearer, directed by Paul Lynch. Bashir's attempt to woo a pretty Bajoran woman with tales of his medical school travails is cut short when he receives word of an emergency at one of the station's landing pads. The runabout Ganges, just returned from the Gamma Quadrant, is so low on power that its hatch cannot be opened, and its oxygen levels are also dangerously low. After O'Brien quickly jury-rigs a method to open the hatch, he is surprised to discover that one of the occupants is an archaeologist named Vash, whom he had previously encountered while serving aboard the Enterprise. O'Brien is even more surprised when Dax relates that the Ganges found Vash in the Gamma Quadrant, where she'd been living for over 2 years, dropped off by a friend, presumably not Superman. Unknown to the station crew, that friend has also arrived on DS9. It's Q, the curious, omnipotent being so frequently encountered by the Enterprise. Despite persistent questioning by Sisko, Vash remains mysterious about her journey to the Gamma Quadrant. She stores some exotic artifacts at the station's assay office, which attracts the attention of the opportunistic Quark, and decides to take up an offer extended by the Daystrom Institute to travel to Earth and brief the scientists there on her recent exploits. As O'Brien fills Sisko in on Vash's relationship with the Enterprise and with Captain Picard, the station is briefly struck by a sudden loss of power, which Dax points out is similar to the phenomenon that disabled the Ganges. Meanwhile, Q pays a visit to Vash and unsuccessfully attempts to revive their precious partnership. She is more interested in a proposition from Quark. He volunteers to stage an auction for her artifacts for a percentage of the profits. When O'Brien spots Q on the promenade, the anomalies aboard the station seem to make sense, but Q denies creating the continuing power outages, and seeing an opportunity for an interesting method of sizing up his new Starfleet adversary, places Sisko and himself in a boxing ring to duke it out. Amazed when Sisko decks him, after all, Picard never hit him, Q withdraws from the action temporarily. Yet even in his absence, the station continues to experience power outages, followed by increases in the graviton field that are causing increasingly dangerous breaches in the hull. At his wit's end, Sisko allows Dax to flood the station with small amounts of tritium gas to trace the source of the power drain. Yawn, boring techno babble. Q returns to taunt Sisko's efforts and suggests that the real threat to the station may actually be Vash, who's down in Quark's for the auction. The graviton field continues to increase to the point where the station is actually being pulled out of its normal position and headed straight for the wormhole. At last, Dax manages to trace the power drain to one of Vash's artifacts from the Gamma Quadrant, and O'Brien beams it off the station just as the object explodes in a brilliant flash of light. Then, out of the flash emerges a winged creature, which soars away towards the wormhole as the astonished inhabitants of DS9 watch. With the life form gone, everything returns to normal at the station. Q reluctantly bids Vash farewell and leaves her in only slightly more reputable hands than his own, as Vash opts to forget about her trip to Earth and strike up a partnership with Quark. The end. Yeah, it is rather a boring synopsis, isn't it? Why did they not...
No, the synopsis was fine.
All right.
The synopsis was fine.
Why did they not just beam them out of the Ganges at the beginning?
Radiation?
All right, okay.
It's radiation.
all right, fair enough. Did we like this one, guys?
I did. Go ahead, Paul. I'm certain. I'm sensing, Paul, that your thoughts are troubled, and you didn't like this one that much. What's up with that?
I hate this one. It's not I didn't like it. I hate this one.
Oh wow.
And I'll get the two positives out of the way first, because I do think there were two positives, and I'll see what you guys think about those, and then I'll start talking about some negatives. Or do you want to just do round table on positives and then get to the negatives?
I don't really have too many positives myself, so
okay. Go ahead. Yeah, we'll do the.
I'll give you my two. The two shining moments in this dark, bleak episode of
this miasma of mediocrity.
Yeah. Oh, I think it strives to reach mediocrity and fails. The moment at the beginning when Bashir is giving his story and you just see O'Brien looking on with disgust, I like that. And the only thing about it that really makes it worthwhile to have sat through this episode is when Sisko decks Q and he says, "You hit me. Picard never hit me." That's it. Other than that, I have no positives in this episode.
It's got to be a very short episode then. I'm not as down on it as Paul is. I don't think it's good. I think it's another prime example of what we're seeing very early on in the show, that they thought it was just going to be the Next Generation. So they've populated it with characters that have appeared on that show. And as it's finding its feet, we're learning that it isn't that. And the quicker the writers realise that, the better the show gets. And once again, we've got two characters who work perfectly well on that show, not working at all well here. Even the normally very reliable John DeLancey seems out of his element in this one. He still has a few funny lines and he still has a few moments because he's got away with dialogue. But Q does not suit this scenario. The Enterprise crew kind of tolerate him in a humorous way. Over here on DS9, they just don't like him. They just want him gone. They're not even interested in entertaining his ridiculous pranks. So there's nothing for him to do that is any way interesting. Vash could have been interesting because she's very much a throwback. She's very much what humanity used to be like. She's opportunistic and in it for herself. She's Indiana Jones before he learned there was more than fortune and glory. So there could have been more made of her working with Quark, but sadly, despite those being the best scenes in the episode, they never really follow up on it. And it's a missed opportunity. He doesn't work as well with this crew as he does with the Enterprise crew. It's trying to make the show into the Next Generation, which they obviously thought it would be at the beginning, and it isn't. And the minute it starts forging its own identity, the better the show gets.
Yeah, well, but I kind of think the idea of Q being on the show was specifically to distinguish it from Next Generation, to show how Q and the elements of the Next Generation don't work with the show. And I agree, Q doesn't feel correct. He doesn't feel like he's a part of this. And I think that's what they're trying to get at. You know, the Next Generation is different than this. And I think this is possibly the writers trying to say that we're trying to make this a little bit different than Next Generation. Q worked phenomenally on Next Generation. He worked really well on Voyager, but yes, he's not a good fit here because Deep Space Nine is not a good fit for Voyager, or is not a good fit to be compared to Voyager and Next Gen. So that's kind of how I took, looked at the character of Q showing up here.
I wanted to know why everyone immediately fell in love with Vash, which means cow in French.
I'm with you on that, because you said they wanted to bring back people from TNG. If you want to do that, actually bring back characters who worked when they were on TNG. She was in two episodes of TNG. She has no charisma at all. She's really just totally vacuous. I can't stand her character. I see nothing about her that would engage Picard or would engage an omnipotent being. I mean, the only reason why Q might be interested is in order to make Picard jealous. But for her to turn Q into a sniveling thing who's trying to get her affection and her interest and is feeling like she's, she's worth fighting for because she's rejecting him, it's just ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. She's got zero going for her. She's not. Not that I look at her and say, "Oh, she's ugly" or anything. She's kind of pretty, but that's it. There's nothing.
No, that's what I mean. She had more with Armin Shimerman in the one, two scenes that they get together than she has with John DeLancey, and arguably with Patrick Stewart, despite the fact that allegedly they were knocking boots in real life for a while. So it's not that she couldn't have worked. I think put her in an adventure with Quark and she could have worked quite well. and if we'd have seen an Indiana Jones type adventure with her in that role, like they tried to do in the Captain's Holiday episode of The Next Generation, where it didn't work for budgetary reasons. They couldn't afford to make Raiders of the Lost Ark on a television budget. And it's, I don't have the problem. I think Jennifer Hetrick's fine with what she's given. I just don't think she's given a particularly interesting character. And she doesn't make the lovable rogue aspects of it work. She doesn't have Harrison Ford's ability to make the roguish charming, and she just comes across as opportunistic. I mean, Armin Shimerman can do that as well. You still
have Kate Capshaw's charm.
No, that's true. She doesn't have Armin Shimerman's ability as well to make being slightly dubious and slightly off-center attractive and interesting. And she just comes across as very selfish. And you've got to wonder how she got through Gene Roddenberry's rules in the first place. How did she get on the show?
Well, if what you say about, you know, her, you know, having a relationship with Patrick
Swayze,
allegedly, that might lead some credence to how she was able to get the part, but you never know.
Well, I think it happened as of Captain's Holiday. I don't think it was before. Yeah. But there's also the thing, John DeLancey has criticised this one for exactly the same reasons that Paul did. He said Q is much more interesting when he's engaging us in a metaphysical conversation about the nature of life. He complained that this episode was basically just Q chasing a skirt, and he had very little interest in it as a plot. He enjoyed the scenes he got to do with Avery Brooks. This is all in the DS9 companion, by the way, where he talks about it. It also doesn't help that this is just a couple of weeks later in terms of real life was followed by Tapestry, which is a much better Q episode of The Next Generation.
Tapestry, for argument's sake, is one of the best episodes of TNG, one of the best episodes of Star Trek, I think, period.
Yeah.
To compare that to this is just, you know, that's a first round knockout, to go with the boxing metaphor.
It's a wasted opportunity. And I mean, obviously they had to do it because people will have been very, well, where's Q? And then having done it, we get the chance as the audience to say, well, that's why Q's not in it. And after this, he would never be in DS9 again. He would show up quite a lot on Voyager, but he would never appear in this show again.
Well, I think that's because specifically that's, you know, you mentioned Q works best when he's engaging the crew on a metaphysical level. That's not what Deep Space Nine is about, and that goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. You know, Deep Space Nine, although it does handle, you know, very heady topics like religion and politics and all this, you know, Q's sort of omnipotence really doesn't work well when you've got omnipotent characters such as the prophets to deal with. And, you know, I think eventually, you know, the characters of the prophets worked better in Deep Space Nine than Q did. And it was just a way, I think, it's still first season jitters. They're not really certain where the direction of the show is going to go. So they throw in as much as they can to try and get people who are interested in Star Trek The Next Generation to come over to this show. So it didn't bother me as much as it seemed to bother Paul. Sorry.
I'm actually happy that we, you know, I don't want to disagree with you all the time, but I'm happy that we're not just one, you know, one group mind, that we all like the same things, we dislike the same things. I think that takes away from some of the entertainment ability of the show if we're just going to agree on everything.
See, one of the things that I didn't like, you know, about, you know, that I kind of got the vibe between Vash and Q was a sort of Maddie and Dave moonlighting type feel, especially the scene of them in the bedroom where they're going back and forth. Granted, it's nowhere as good as Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis, but I got that kind of feel, and that gave me a sort of nostalgic feel for that type of stuff. And I don't know whether you guys got that or felt
I got a moonlighting vibe from their relationship as well. But like you say, I think John DeLancey can pull off Bruce Willis. I don't think Jennifer Hetrick's as good as Sybil Shepherd for the bouncing back thing. So I agree. I think John DeLancey could have pulled that off with I don't want to say a better actress, because I don't think she's bad, but with an actress who is capable of going toe-to-toe with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this actress is capable of going toe-to-toe with John DeLancey. You need somebody of Patrick Stewart's stature to go toe-to-toe with John DeLancey and Jennifer.
Yeah, and they really just didn't do the moonlighting thing.
No. It's I mean, I can see what they were going for. And there are some funny lines in it. Like when O'Brien says to Q, why do you go do something useful like Tormic Cardassians? That was funny. And Bashir's constant horn dog status was moderately amusing in this episode. But it did seem to be that everyone fell for Vash at every opportunity. We do get a problem in this one that crops up all throughout the various different iterations of Star Trek in many ways, and will crop up in the next episode that we cover next week, that because they don't actually have a different set, they redress Quark's bar for the auction. And did you notice there was one of the aliens from the Next Gen episode Lonely Among Us, the Antican or the Sele, was one of the people in the auction?
I didn't notice that.
I didn't see Morn in this one.
No,
I did. I saw him twice.
Right. Okay. Yeah,
I've been, you know, because I'm obsessive compulsive, I've started up a Excel file.
Morn spreadsheet.
Yes, I have a Morn spreadsheet for Morn sightings. I even wrote down in my notes at 9:42 into the show was the first Morn sighting. He was
excellent.
He was walking it. I think what was it, Bosch and. Maybe it was either Bosch and Sisko or Bosch and O'Brien were walking along the promenade, and Morn walked in behind them. So
that's excellent. My wife was watching this one with me, and she did point out something she thought was a bit odd. When Q and Vash are having their conversation, and she says something like, "You're arrogant and overbearing, and you know everything," and Q says, "I do know everything," he immediately follows us up by asking, "What does she want?" And Ange said, I find it amusing that Q knows everything, but even an omnipotent being doesn't know what a woman wants.
Okay, you know what? I would have never noticed that, but I'll give that credit for them doing that intentionally and that being funny.
Yeah, because she thought that was amusing.
But, I mean, like I said, there was just scenes in there, like, I don't know why, but I cringe at the scene when Quark is talking to the potential buyer. And he says, and you get a certificate of authenticity from Vash. And he says it like she's this goddess. and they put a close up on her, and she's got this like wry little smile on her face. And it's just like, it just doesn't work. You don't, you know, they think everybody watching the show is going to fall in love with her because she's just oozing with charisma. And she's not. And that's the problem I think I have with her character in all three episodes she's in. I don't know why Picard would be infatuated with her, other than to annoy Picard. I don't know why Q would be infatuated with her. And I don't know why they think that everybody on the station is just going to adore her.
Yeah, it seems like they had much more stock in her than we did. I don't know, maybe she was... No, I don't want to say that, do I? That's very derogatory. I won't say that. I won't go down that thought train. It's the main characters that serve it. Armin Shimerman's brilliant as usual, and he does manage to bring the best out in Jennifer Hetrick. So maybe we should have had more with her and him than we had with her and John Delancey. Cole Meany wears his "geez, I've had enough of this crap" face all the way through this episode.
Well, if you had to be dealing with the sort of arrogant smugness that we saw in Bashir at the beginning, you know, I'm about sick of Bashir's horn dogness. I want him to move on to a better character arc.
That'll reach a real apex for me in the next episode rather than this one.
Yes.
Because O'Brien's reaction to it saved it in this one. Because O'Brien sat there going, "This really works on women?" And Bashir's just not letting it go, is he? And then he immediately falls for Vash. And you're like, oh, God, get over it, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a bit of a Chekhov moment with O'Brien, because when Vash comes in, he recognizes her right away, and he wasn't actually in either of the episodes that she was in TNG.
Oh, is that all right? I did not know that. But now that I think about it, no, yeah, he's not in the Captain's Holiday. I wouldn't have known whether he's in Cupid or not.
But it's basically Chekhov and Khan.
Well, he was part of the crew. So yeah, just because you didn't see him doesn't mean he wasn't there. That's
that is the answer everybody gives to Chekhov and Khan, knowing him, is that he wasn't part of the command crew at that point, but he was, you know, an ensign or whatever on the ship, and you know, we just didn't see him because he wasn't on the bridge.
Exactly.
So,
which
you know,
is fair enough. I can live with that.
Yeah. Oh, you can explain it away, but they never had a scene together until the scene when he recognizes her.
Mm. Was O'Brien in a Q episode? Oh, yeah, he was in Encounter at Farpoint, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, the ending to this was very Encounter at Farpoint-like to me, when they set the whatever it is free. It reminded me of the being at the end of Encounter at Farpoint that they have to set free.
Yeah, and but we don't
shockingly
have Marina
enough
Sirtis
another
is,
Q episode.
We don't have Marina Sirtis' truly awful performance at the end of this one. Great joy and happiness. We don't have any of that, thankfully. To her credit, she hates that performance as well, so she wouldn't get upset at me saying that. I think Jane Badler would have been better in this role.
Who is that?
Because at the time, Jane, she was Diana in V, and she'll have just been doing Mission Impossible, the new version of Mission Impossible at about this time. So she'll have been working for Paramount. I think Jane Badler would have been better as Vash.
Quite possibly. Like I said, you need somebody who just on her look alone is going to kind of engage you and make you, you know, want to know more about her. And I don't think Jennifer Hetrick does that. I just don't. I, there's nothing about her that stands out. She looking at her to me is almost the definition of an average pretty person. You know, she could get lost in. If you put her in with other pretty women, she's just lost in the crowd. She doesn't stand out.
Yeah, she's no Kira, is she?
No, sadly, both of the females in the main cast, you know, run rings around her and the prettiness, and then the prettiness arc. So yeah,
and personality.
You put
as well.
Sitting chairs together, and none of them say anything. She's still the last one you're going to. And the other two have. When they speak, have more charisma than her too, so that's not going to help her any.
Yeah, we also get famous Next Generation ending, which is techno babble, oh alien, we don't understand, oh techno babble, mm-hmm. And the DS9 will get away from that as well.
Yeah, that was
wouldn't
one
it
of
have
things.
Been, wouldn't it have been fun if they set free the creature and it just went on a rampage, destroying the station?
there was a reason
it had been in that thing.
See the thing that I disliked was, again, this is a little bit of the physics. You know, they say the gravitons are pulling the station out of orbit and, you know, going to crash into the wormhole. But if you look upon the station, there's no yellow alert, there's no red alert going on. People are just walking around like nothing's happening. They can't look out the window and see, oh, we're hurtling through space for no apparent reason.
So basically, if they turned DS9 here into Moonbase Alpha, that would have been a much funner episode.
Oh, I would have
loved it. You just hurl Deep Space Nine across space and set it on September 13th, and we're laughing.
Exactly. Thank you, Jerry Anderson. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's... Paul's made me dislike it more than I did when I was watching it.
Yeah.
And I've done my job.
Yeah, you know, now that you pointed this stuff out, I think I may drop my overall score maybe a half a point, but yeah. Do we want to go ahead and do we have anything else that we want to talk about on this episode?
No, because it's sold on John DeLancey being in it, and once we've discussed John DeLancey, there's not really much else to this episode. I mean, Sisko punching him's fun, mm-hmm. but one good moment in a 46 minute episode does not a good episode make.
And what I would say is, we were talking, I don't know if it was last episode or the episode before that, but we were talking about if you were flipping through the channels. I think it was the episode before. I think it was Babel.
Yeah.
And because we were saying it wasn't that good, but I said, but if I was flipping through the channels and that was on, I would still stop and leave it on. This episode, no. Honestly, if I saw this one, if I saw DS9, I'm stopping, and then I see it's this episode of DS9, and I'm continuing to surf the channels at that point. I'm not stopping.
I'd leave the boxing scene on. And then I'd move channels. I'd watch Sisko punch him.
That would probably be the only... If I was lucky enough to catch it at that moment, I would do it. But I don't even think I would go back to it to try and get that if I had turned it on like 3 minutes before that episode, that moment happened. I wouldn't leave. Right.
Fair enough.
So it's closer to the naked now than it is to Jaws, basically.
It is so close to the naked now. In fact, it's like butted up right against it.
Okay, well, scores of bars of cold pressed platinum then, so I can put this down in our little spreadsheet.
You know, I would have gone for 3 until I spoke to Paul, and now it gets 2. And I would have only give it the 3 for John DeLancey. John DeLancey alone gets a gold press platinum bar, so I've knocked it down 1. So basically, it's a one Latinum episode elevated to 2 pieces of Latinum for having John DeLancey in it.
All right then, Paul.
I just the thought of a 3 to me is boggling my mind on this. I mean, I gave Babel a 2, and I think that's superior to this. I'm torn on whether I give this a 1 or if I give it a half. This might well be my least favorite episode, but it's been so long since I've done a complete watch through that I want to leave myself just a little room in case there's an episode worse than this. So I'm giving it a 1.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Well, you know, I actually enjoyed this quite a bit. I mean, yes, it...
I'm not sure we could be friends anymore.
Okay, well, sorry, everyone. Listen to the Prophets. We'll no longer be doing...
Listen to the Prophets is now looking for a new co-host to join Paul and I.
You know what? You guys might have to kick me off because Sean is the producer. Neither of us is willing to take that from him.
See, I don't have the producing talent that you do, Paul. So we'll just keep it going, and I'll just suffer silently, I guess. I was going to give it a 3. I think it's a little above average. I like the inclusion of Q. I will agree with you that Vosh is not an interesting character, but her dealings with Quark, and I think again the main cast, specifically Quark, is what makes this episode enjoyable for me. Yes, it's not a great episode, but I think there are going to be episodes further down the line that make this one look stellar. So, I'm going to give it a 3 bars. So, yeah.
You know, it's just I'm thinking about it, and it would be interesting. You know, you talked about how you want to distinguish it from DS9 with Q. And as a general rule, I like all of the Q episodes from TNG, with the exception of the Sherwood Forest episode. So I still think it's Vash that's killing him for me. But I think I would have really liked to have seen an episode where Q comes to DS9 and he's playing his pranks and everything, and he just kind of gets bored because they're not engaging him, and everybody seems just so dour to him that he says, "This isn't any fun, I'm leaving." Almost like Mr. Mixius Pitalik. You know, that he's truly a prankster in the episode, as opposed to you know, getting all meta with them or anything, and just, you know, just isn't having fun because of the way they react. They're just too damn serious for him, and he leaves. And I think that could have been a very good episode.
Mm. Yeah, see, I like all the Q ones except Hyde and Q, which I just think is risible, particularly the oh so smug ending where they give Riker the power of the Q and Picard just sits there like really haughty-taughty in his chair, letting Riker make his own mistakes. That's an awful episode. I mean, Wesley gets stabbed in it, which is good, but other than that, that one's awful. Not this isn't as bad as that on the plus side.
Yeah, we're finding ways to compare it to crappier episodes. I don't know if that's actually propping it up very well. So yeah,
yeah. Of the crap episodes, this isn't as crap as them. Isn't a glowing recommendation, is it?
Yeah, it's when Paul says it's butting up next to Naked Now. Yeah, you've got to think that maybe this isn't the one you want to show all your friends to get them interested in Deep Space Nine. Well, I think we've got a couple of emails. Do we want to go ahead and read through those?
Sure.
Incoming transmission.
Okay. If you want, I will take the first one. This one is from Jason Trenner, and he asks, hey, where is the earth-shattering kaboom? Should I read that in my Marvin the Martian voice? Hey, where is the earth-shattering kaboom? That's awful. Sorry.
Look at you doing voices.
No, I'm... I'm not quite Dr. Bill. Which I guess
there,
you know, we'll have.
There was
to
no earth-shattering kaboom. that's my Marvin the Martian.
That is awesome. Jason writes, "Hey guys, glad episode 3 of DS9 picked up for you. For TNG, they had, oh god, Code of Honor. Not even good by season one of Next Generation standards, or really any standards at all, to be honest.
I was going to say that. I was going to interrupt Jason's email there and say not good by any measure of good.
I had no idea that the Admiral in the episode was played by the wife of Spock. That's kind of cool, actually. For Voyager, to be honest, it squandered everything. All that it could be, it never used it. Frankly, makes me wonder why they set it in the Delta Quadrant, given the fact that they never really wanted to explore what being lost so far away could be like or do to the ship. Well beyond the USS Equinox and the Equinox two-parter, where we got to see what, without a reset button, Voyager would have been like. Shocked there hasn't been an Equinox novel exploring the devastation, their devastating and rough-as-hell journey through the Delta Quadrant.
Well, if you want to see what Voyager would have been like, go and watch the new Battlestar Galactica. Because that's everything Voyager could have been and wasn't. And we don't want to bash on Voyager. Voyager had a couple of good episodes. But yeah, it never lived up to its premise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole idea, because it seemed that they had shuttlecrafts aplenty, and whatever they needed, you know, weaponry, photon torpedoes or whatever, they could find enough to make. So, and no one really was starving. The only time you really got a bad one was that Year of Hell, like two-part.
Yeah, which was a great episode until the end, and when you realize that the bad guy was called Anorax, which was a dig at the fans. But yeah, Battlestar Galactica covered all of that, what it was like to be on a fleet where the food's running out, where did they get their ammunition from, and by the end of the series, the Galactica was held together by chewing gum and baling wire.
But Jason continues, says, anyway, we got Garrick, who I remember months ago going, okay, if this is going to be a Wild West show where the new sheriff comes to town, how does a spy hiding out there fit in? He's a remarkable and interesting character who definitely added to the show. And of course, we remember him being an even bigger part of the show, as frankly, he kicked ass, and seeing his reaction to, frankly, James Bond on the holodeck down the road was wonderful. Love the show, and we'll keep listening. And that's for
yeah. Sorry, go on.
Oh, go ahead. I said that's from Jason Trenor.
I was just going to say, it's such a shame when you realize Garrick was only in one first season episode, and we've already covered it.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think that was probably, you know, I can check the spreadsheet, hold on, and see what we said. So far, I think our highest ranking was for the pilot episode, and then past prologue was our next highest one, so... Yeah, everyone loves Garrick, which should replace that one with Ray Romano in my perspective.
Oh, I would so watch that.
You know, it would really be funny to see that as a sitcom. Everybody loves Garrick. You have him, you know, in the title credits, like he bumps into Odo and they just start laughing.
Oh, God. I've got the theme music playing in my head now. Kind of jaunty tune with Garrick walking into walls and things like that.
I'm kind of picturing almost a Quantum Leap type theme song.
Okay, does someone
sorry,
else...
Sorry for exhausting you mentally, Sean.
It's all good. Do you want to read the next one, Paul? Do you have email open, or do we need to...
Let me just open it up and we'll get right to it. It's from Gene Hendricks. Mm-hmm. It is titled Babel. Tree, brook, dog, glue, salad, man, ready, lock. All right, that's enough. Excuse me, I went right into it not even realizing. All right, that's enough of that. I was trying to be clever, and it was just too annoying. Yes, this was a goofy kind of episode, and now that Andy mentioned it, I can see the next gen in it. However, I like some of the characterization. Odo pretty much panicking when he has to do something in ops was great, as was Quark's mercenary qualities coming through. He helped, but he expects payment later. Then there's Kira's kidnapping someone and forcing him to find the cure. That just says loads about her backstory. Beyond those character bits, though, it was pretty dull, especially with the Deus Ex Machina solution at the end. But as Paul said, a bad episode of DS9 is still better than most shows.
Paul might be disagreeing you this episode, I would say.
By the way, Sean, are you referring to the Monster Maroon uniforms? Trust me, they may look good, but they are freaking hot, especially under the filming lights. Yes, that's me in the far lower left, but that is also my wife in the red wig above and to the right of me.
Yeah, and I took a look at the picture, and yeah, that is the uniform. It's the classic Star Trek II uniform, and I've seen versions of it for sale online, and I still think I can imagine it's got to be really hot, because essentially it's like a white turtleneck and then this jacket, long sleeve jacket over it. So yeah, I can imagine it's not comfortable wearing, but it just looks cool. So,
and I'm picturing a lot of polyester in that.
Well, you know, it was the late 70s, early 80s, so at least it wasn't kind of as awkward as the sort of jumpsuit pajama type uniform from the first the Star Trek the Motion Picture. That was the one uniform that I just couldn't get behind, unfortunately.
Well, if it was as a pair of pajamas, I think I could. Because they look very comfortable to sleep in.
I think they were ahead of the time. The onesie, man, it's in now. Star Trek got there first.
Okay. Yeah,
my daughter's all over the onesie. She's walking around in her onesie leopard pajamas right now.
Nice.
Yeah, Anya has a tiger one.
Yes. Very, very popular. We should just give credit to Gene that he does the Hammer Strikes podcast, the Quantum Cast, and Anime Freaks with our friend Dr. Bill Robinson.
Mm-hmm. Who is going to be essentially the fourth member of the show eventually? Isn't he the B.A. Baracus to our
to our Hannibal Face and Murdoch?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
But yeah, I say we hold off on the emails until the next show, and we'll just go from there. Sound good?
I'm thinking just from the A-team thing, I'm thinking it's face, face, and face. But that's besides the point.
No, I want to be Hannibal, dude.
Done.
I've got a lot of crazy in me that just needs to come out.
Well, isn't then wouldn't you want to be Murdoch?
No, I'm the acceptable edge of crazy. People think that it's perfectly acceptable and normal, but I'm on the jazz, man. I'm on the jazz.
All right. Well, there's some crossing of the streams right there. Well, hopefully our next episode won't be as miserable as... I mean, not particularly, you know, us doing the episode, but the episode of the show.
I don't think that was miserable.
This episode has been wonderful. It's just the show that wasn't done. I'm going to shut up now. Andy, tell us what's happening next time. So.
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophet, Star Trek does courtroom drama again. But sadly, William Shatner isn't around to be Denny Crane as Dax is put on trial for a crime she didn't commit. Or did she? Is that it? Did we just go out there?
Why not?
All right, okay. Are we
gonna... I think that works. We don't have to say goodbye.
They know we're leaving.
Yeah, we've said that's it. It's just cut.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
40th, we went and did one of these package tours and had, went with a bunch of people and, stayed at different sites. I think we did Florence, we did Rome, we did Venice. It was just a heck of a lot of fun. So I hope you'll like Venice. There's a lot of neat stuff to look, to see around there.
Well, he's going for art class. So.
Oh, okay.
Is that when you met Signor DiManzo?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's where he recruited me for the network. So
he recruited you. He blackmailed us.
He
came up behind him with a pillowcase, put it over his head. Woke up with one kidney missing.
In a bath.
The recruiting has its own special meaning in Italy. So there you go. It's they're all different levels of recruitment, I guess.
I was listening to Neil Adams on Fat Man on Batman, and he was saying that he had argued with, I think, DC about comic pricing, and surprisingly, he was not. Usually he's the advocate of the little guy, but he certainly wasn't on this one, because he started saying that if they charge, say, 50 cents for a comic book now. He said the retailers don't want to promote it, because why should they promote it when they, if they sell a comic for 50 cents, their profit is 25 cents. But if they sell a magazine for $4, their profit is $2. Hmm. And he says, just the profit margin alone makes the retailer not want to promote the comics.
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons they gave for Untold Tales of Spider-Man's failure, wasn't it? For me, that was the best Spider-Man book of the 90s, and nobody was buying it because it was only 99 cents, and it was largely because the retailers weren't promoting it because they weren't making any money off it. But quality wise that was pissing all over everything else that was being published at the time.